Hello and welcome to Animal Voices. You're listening to CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Lauren Corman, here with Carl Orzechowski, bringing us some news. Today's program, we have two different interviews lined up for you. But before I tell you about those interviews, I did want to let people know that the Vegan Muscle Power Show is now online. So if you're interested in vegan bodybuilding and the world of holistic nutrition, please do check out that interview. It was a great interview with Kenneth Williams and Evelyn Williams. You can go to our website, animalvoices.ca, and check us out there. If you have any questions or comments for Animal Voices, we'd love to hear from you. You can write us at animalvoices@gmail.com. And this upcoming show is also going to be, I think, a lot of fun. First up, we're going to be talking with Sarah Kramer. We're going to hear about her new book. I won't give too much away, but she needs some help from our audience. So hopefully you'll be able to lend a hand to Sarah Kramer. She's one of the people that is behind the very famous books, How It All Began and The Gardener Vegan. And she also went out on her own and she did a book called La Dolce Vegan, which we had her on to talk about as well. So that's going to be at about quarter after. And then we're going to be turning to an interview with BETA, Beirut for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. We talked to people from this organization in 2006 during the conflict with Israel. We wanted to find out what's been happening there in the interim, and a lot has been. So I think it'll be a good program. So we're going to be speaking with people in Lebanon at about 11:30. But before we do that, we're going to go over to Carl.
Hi, everybody. So bringing you the news this week is me. My name is Carl Orzechowski, and this week we have a few shorter news pieces. The first one's coming to us from the timesonline.co.uk website, and the headline is, Animal-Human Embryo Research is Approved. Experiments to create Britain's first embryos that combine human and animal material will begin within months after a government watchdog gave its approval yesterday to two research teams to carry out the controversial work. Scientists at King's College London and the University of Newcastle will inject human DNA into empty eggs from cows to create embryos known as cytoplasmic hybrids, which are 99.9% human in genetic terms. The experiments are intended to provide insights into diseases such as Parkinson's and spinal muscular atrophy by producing stem cells containing genetic defects that contribute to these conditions, and these will be used as cell models for investigating new approaches to treatment and to improve the understanding of how embryonic cells develop. They will not be used in therapy, as it is illegal to implant them into the womb. The decision, taken by the Human Fertilization and Embryology Authority, or the HFEA, to grant a one-year license to both teams, ends more than a year of uncertainty for the researchers who first applied for permission in the autumn of 2006. Last January, the authority deferred its decision and began a consultation on the issue, which reported in September that the public was broadly supportive. In late November, it again delayed the ruling because of concerns about procedures for obtaining consent from the donors of the human DNA to be used. While the HFEA was deliberating, the government proposed a ban on the creation of human-animal embryos, also known as chybrids, but retreated after a revolt by scientists. The creation of human-animal embryos will be explicitly permitted by the Human Fertilization and Embryology Bill, currently passing through Parliament. An amendment that would have blocked such research was defeated in the House of Lords on Monday by a majority of 172. Stephen Menger, who leads the King's team, said yesterday he was delighted that he would be able to start the experiments. Quote, I am pleased that the HFEA has finally, after a year and a half, realized the importance that the work that we and the group from Newcastle will have been licensed for, he said. Lyle Armstrong, who leads the Newcastle group, said, quote, finding better ways to make human embryonic stem cells is the long-term objective of our work, and understanding reprogramming is central to this. Cow eggs seem to be every bit as good at doing this job as human eggs, so it makes sense to use them since they are much more readily available, but it is important to stress that we will only use them as a scientific tool, and we need not worry about cells derived from them ever being used to treat human diseases. Some critics of chybrid embryos have argued that their use is no longer necessary given the recent development of reprogramming techniques that can turn back the clock on adult tissue to make induced pluripotent stem cells with embryo-like properties, but the HFEA license committee rejects this. And the next story, which I encourage you to look up online, because this is a fairly heavily edited version of it, this is coming from the New York Times online version, and the headline is, Chef's New Goal, Looking Dinner in the Eye. And again, you can look this up on the New York Times website. It's one of their free articles, and I do encourage you to read the whole thing. Last Friday, in front of 4 million television viewers and a studio audience, the chef Jamie Oliver killed a chicken. Having recently obtained a United Kingdom slaughterman license, Mr. Oliver staged a gala dinner to awaken British consumers to the high costs of cheap chicken. Quote, a chicken is a living thing, an animal with a life cycle, and we shouldn't expect it will cost less than a pint of beer in a pub, he said Monday in an interview. Quote, it only costs a bit more to give a chicken a natural life and a reasonably pleasant death, he told the champagne-sipping audience before he stunned the chicken, cut an artery in its throat, and let it bleed to death, all in accordance with British standards for humane slaughter. Mr. Oliver said that he wanted to confront the reality that eating any kind of meat involves killing an animal, even if it is done with a minimum of pain. Many chefs believe absolutely that meat from happy, healthy animals tastes better. But it's not all about what's on the plate. They also believe that if they're going to turn a pig into a plate of pork chops, they should be able to look it in the eye, taking responsibility for both the treatment it receives in life and the manner of its death. Quote, the question is, how and why should we care about an animal when we are going to bloody eat it? Mr. Oliver asked his audience. Some agricultural ethicists believe that if animals could lead comfortable lives and die completely free of fear and pain, raising and killing them would not pose an ethical problem. A few believe in an unwritten domestic contract between humans and domesticated species that includes killing. Others maintain that killing animals is inherently unethical because it cuts off their opportunities for future good experiences, according to Dr. Richard Haynes, the editor of the Journal of Agricultural and Environmental Ethics. Chefs feel that they are in a prime spot to grapple with these issues. Quote, it's our responsibility and our privilege to educate our consumers, said Charlie McManus, the chef owner of Primo Grill in Tacoma, Washington, who has visited his meat supplier, and I'm not making this name up, Cheryl the Pig Lady, in the nearby Puyallup River Valley. He says, quote, a lot of them don't want to hear it, but that's just sticking your head in the sand. Following the broadcast, Mr. Oliver was both praised and attacked by animal rights groups for the killing that took place on stage. Quote, it's nothing that doesn't happen millions of times a day, he said. There was no need to make it any more dramatic than it is. In Mr. Oliver's show, Jamie's Foul Dinners, he served up many shocking moments. He suffocated a clutch of male chicks according to standard egg industry procedure in a chamber of carbon dioxide, stuffed birds into crowded, filthy battery cages that house 95% of the country's chickens, and showed a computer-altered baby picture of himself, grossly engorged to represent the rapid growth of a baby chick on a factory farm. But the most shocking of all may be his revelation that price wars have squeezed the profit margin of the modern poultry farmer to about 6 cents a bird. Mr. Oliver's message to supermarket shoppers is clear. The only reason for the miserable lives lived by most chickens is your insistence on cheap food. Quote, people in the UK really do care about animals, but we are also used to an incredibly low food cost, said Fuchsia Dunlop, a British writer who has lived in China and written extensively about that country's food culture. Quote, this program will have an effect because there is new momentum toward the idea that we should at least see how the food gets to us, and then we can make up our own minds. And finally, the last story of the day coming to us from thecalifornian.com by way of the Associated Press. And the headline is, Tiger Attack Victim Admits Taunting Animal at San Francisco Zoo. One of the three victims of the Christmas Day San Francisco Zoo tiger attack was intoxicated and admitted standing atop a railing of the big cat enclosure and yelling and waving at the animal that would later maul and kill his friend, police said in court documents filed Thursday. Paul Dhaliwal, 19, told the father of Carlos Souza Jr., 17, who was killed, that the three yelled and waved at the tiger, but Dhaliwal insisted he never threw anything into the pen to provoke the cat, according to a search warrant affidavit obtained by the San Francisco Chronicle. The affidavit, which requested a search warrant for the surviving victims' cell phones and cars, also cites multiple reports of a group of young men taunting animals at the zoo, the Chronicle reported. toxicology results for Dhaliwal showed that his blood alcohol level was 0.16 after the attack, twice the legal threshold for drunkenness, while his 24-year-old brother Kulbir Dhaliwal's blood alcohol level was 0.04% and Souza's was 0.2%. All three also had marijuana in their systems, Matthew said. Kulbir Dhaliwal told police that the three had smoked pot and each had a couple of shots of vodka before leaving San Jose for the zoo on December 25th, the affidavit said. And that is the end of the news.
Thanks, Carl.
You're welcome.
I know that you were really interested in the Jamie Oliver story.
I was. It's I actually watched a portion of the program where he's essentially suffocating a group of young male chicks. And it was really disturbing. Like, obviously, it's really disturbing to watch chicks being suffocated in a box. It was also really... I don't even know what the word is for it. It's hard to find words for a spectacle like that. It was really disconcerting, kind of heartening in a way, because you could see... This was done in front of a live studio audience of people wearing tuxedos and very nice dinnerware and sipping, and as the article said, sipping champagne and that sort of thing. So I don't know if these people were expecting what they got. And they genuinely seemed really shocked, surprised, and horrified. And when those chicks were being suffocated, like, people were breaking down and crying. And, like, I didn't see the rest of the show, so I don't know how people reacted throughout. I don't know if I really want to see the rest of the show. But that being said, I'm not saying that what he did was necessarily a good thing, but it is definitely, no pun intended, food for thought. I can definitely say that it really got me thinking, although not thinking about doing that myself.
One of the, I guess, perspectives that's missing from that article that I know some of our listeners are probably thinking about is the idea that even if he dealt with the welfare conditions and gave them, I think he talks about a happy death as well, mm-hmm. that it doesn't really remove the fact that the whole institution is built on the commodification of life. And mm-hmm. I know that sounds like an extremist statement to some people, but if we're going to go with Gary Francione's sort of moral baseline about whether or not you are allowed to or should have the right to consider another living being property, it sort of like throws a wedge into some of that discussion.
Yeah.
And some of the stuff around free range too, and this idea that if we could just move to a more natural life for these animals, that the meat consumption that happens in the UK and North America would have to go down so much because there just isn't the land to do that. That's my...
Yeah.
I often don't interject my own perspective, but that's it, I guess.
It's interesting because the article says, you know, perhaps the most shocking thing is that farmers get paid so little. And to me, that's not shocking at all. I mean, I feel like I've been aware that farmers get the short end of the stick for a very long time, but the fact that someone can kill a chicken on stage in front of people, and that's well within the law, that to me is someone shot. That's the shocking thing, and that, like, this can happen, and there's no recourse, there's no discussion of animal cruelty or any kind of thing. I mean, it just becomes part of a spectacle that's a show and gets ratings, and Jamie Oliver gets paid really well to do this kind of thing. So yeah.
It's, you know, it's interesting too, because I think a large portion of the animal rights movement has focused historically on visibility issues, and if we could just see the death, then mm-hmm. things would change. And I think it's kind of an interesting line of argument, and this is a displaying of death in order to make a moral argument as well, but it's different than mm-hmm. what we usually see in terms of an animal
yeah.
rights kind of, you know, yeah, perspective.
No. Yeah.
There's so much really to... I think that I'm probably doing the wrong topic for my dissertation, because there's just a lot going on there, mm-hmm. you know, to think about the public's spectacle and watching a death like that, and that we consume that animal's death that way.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't necessarily think that's better than having it happen behind closed doors.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the rise of industrial agriculture and everything became secretive.
Yeah, it just totally spun me out in terms of thinking about these issues. And again, I do encourage everyone to check it out. It is online, and we'll actually have the link to the full story on our website, animalvoices.ca.
These are just our opinions, and I appreciate you bringing the story to us. And if you want to share your opinion on any of this, please do write us at animalvoices@gmail.com if you want to make a comment about anything that you've heard on the program, or if you have any ideas for upcoming shows, we'd love to hear from you. Again, our email is animalvoices@gmail.com. Today we're speaking with Sarah Kramer. We're going to be finding out about her new book, and so we have her coming up right away, and then in about 11:30 or so, we're also going to be connecting with people from Beirut for the Ethical Treatment of Animals and finding out more about what has happened in Beirut and with the shelters that they run there since we talked to them in August 2006. But before we jump into that, it's my great pleasure to welcome Sarah Kramer back onto the show.
Da-da-da-da!
How's it going, Sarah?
I'm tired. It's early over here on the left coast.
So you said that you were going to be talking to me in your pajamas. So did that actually happen? Are you still in your pajamas?
I woke up naked this morning. I don't know what happened. Do you ever do that when you just, like, you go to bed in your pajamas and you wake up and you're like, whoa, I'm nude. How did that happen? So I'm actually in my husband's house coat right now.
Okay.
So don't worry, I'm not nude.
You know, I think that would be a new...
Or am I?
Yeah, it could be a new angle for the show. Maybe, yeah. I'm nude too, Sarah.
Maybe. Ooh.
Maybe nude. We're all nude.
Nude.
Okay, this
voices.
Is getting dirty.
So tell us about your new book.
Oh, geez. My new book. It's called Vegan A Go-Go, and it's a compilation of the sort of the best of recipes from the first three books. But it's tiny. It's about the size of a Moleskin journal. So it's a travel book that you can take with you when you visit your family or your parents or you go on a trip, so that you have your favorite recipes with you. And then also included are some new recipes and travel tips for me and sort of my experiences with traveling around North America, doing book signings, that kind of stuff. So it's going to be a tiny little precious book that you will keep with your passport and treat with just as much care and love.
So how's that? That sounds good. What was the inspiration then for doing this project?
I went to Vancouver to have a meeting with my publishers, and they hypnotized me, and the next thing I knew, I signed a contract, and I was writing another book. I don't know what happened. It's all a blur. The inspiration, it just... I travel a lot, and my publisher actually pitched the idea to me, and I realized that I do have a lot of tips and a lot of little things that I do, because traveling at the best times is really difficult, and then when you add vegan to that, it's just one more thing that you have to worry about. So when I sat down and started to write just a brief outline, I realized that I do a lot of specific things to sort of keep from starving and to keep healthy when I'm traveling. So hopefully that will all go into the book, and you'll find it enjoyable.
Well, it's interesting, you know, it comes on the heels of, at least in North America, some major holiday celebrations, and that you had mentioned before, I think, that people will email you and say, I don't have this recipe, can you get this to me?
Or... I do. I get tons of email from people who are like, I'm in the middle of nowhere visiting my mom, and all there is a text post station. What can I make to eat? Or, you know, I want to show my parents that I eat really wonderful food, and I don't have my cookbook, because who travels with three cookbooks or even one cookbook? They're big and heavy and bulky and all that stuff. So inspiration really definitely came from there.
Mm. So there's going to be, I assume, crowd pleasers then, if you're trying to fulfill that market that's saying we want to impress our parents.
Yes, well, there'll be a little bit of everything, right? There'll be recipes, that you can make on the fly, and with ingredients that you can find pretty much at 7-Eleven or any sort of corner store. And then there's recipes to impress your family and friends with. So those recipes will have things that you might not be able to necessarily find, but you might have to bring with you, depending on where your family or friends live.
So give us a bit of a teaser then. What are some of the things that you eat when you're traveling?
Oh, God. What do I eat? You know what I do? Is I travel with Vega bars. I don't know if you've tried them, but they're amazing. I always have one in my bag, so that when I am somewhere where I can't find food, I always have my trusty Vega bar with me, because they travel well, because they're in a little package. and they don't need to be refrigerated. And then that way, if I can't find food, I can chomp on my Vega bar, and then I don't get cranky. And then finding food isn't such a disaster, you know, where you know when you get to the point where you haven't eaten, and then you feel like you're going to go crazy, and that maybe it's just me. But I get really panicky if I feel like I'm not going to be able to get food. So I always travel with a Vega bar or, a little bag of nuts and seeds in my bag.
Do you think that's something that people tend not to do, and then they get themselves into kind of a pinch situation?
Yeah, exactly. And then you're in the middle of nowhere, and you can't eat anything. But, you know, saying that, no matter where you are, you can always find peanut butter, banana, and bread. Mm. So everywhere. So, you know, if you're stuck somewhere and you don't know what to do for food, you can always, every supermarket, I think, everywhere has peanut butter, banana, and bread. So,
okay.
Yeah, don't panic.
So is the book called Vegan a Go-Go? That
yes.
is the name. All right.
Vegan a Go-Go.
All
We're
right.
going on a trip.
So when I talked to you before, you said that you were hoping to get feedback from people. Are you still wanting to
yes.
hear?
Yeah, okay. yeah. I asked my readership to send me an email of their favorite recipes from the first three books. And they can send them to my website. They can just send them to sarah@govegan.net. And, I'm trying to put in everybody's favorite recipe so that there's a little bit of everything. Right now, brainless banana pancakes from How It All Began seems to be the number one recipe. Who knew?
So what are some of the other ones that are making the top of the list right now?
That one and the shepherd's pie is a really big one. Wolfie's cheesecake in La Dolce Vegan, that's a really big one. And the other one, coconut chocolate chip cookies from La Dolce Vegan. That one's easy because you can find those ingredients anywhere and they're delicious.
So when you travel then, are you doing a lot of cooking? I mean, I think people probably still have an image of you as very glamorous, living the glamorous lifestyle,
yeah.
traveling around, getting pampered, all that kind of stuff. So tell us about what it's actually like for you to travel. Like, are you doing cooking when you're going places?
It depends. Like, when I come to Toronto, I stay with friends, so I pretty much cook every day. And then, you know, if I'm traveling down in the States, it really depends on where I'm staying. The last time I did my book tour, I was staying in a lot of hotels, so it was sort of depending on the kindness of hotel restaurants.
Mm.
But, you know, again, if you, you know, are friendly to your server and spark a conversation about what you can and can't eat, usually the majority of time the chef or the restaurant will try and make you happy and make you something. But there's lots of times where I've had to, you know, go into some little corner store and get a banana and bread and peanut butter so that I don't starve. Mm. And, you know, making peanut butter sandwiches in the bathroom of your hotel room or whatever, it's quite glamorous, isn't it?
Right, it's, yeah. So it sounds like obviously there's going to be much more than that in the book.
Yes.
Besides
oh, yeah.
that holy trinity that you've outlined for us.
Yes.
So we don't have very much time left, so I'll get you to maybe plug the website again if you have one that you want to direct people towards, and your email address for people to give you feedback about what they'd like to see in the book.
Sure. My website is govegan.net, and my address is sarah@govegan.net. And even if you don't have any ideas for the new book and you just want to say hello, drop me a note. I'm always on the computer.
Okay,
always.
Great. Thanks, Sarah.
Yeah, no problem.
Are you going to go back to bed?
Okay, yeah, no, I have another interview at 9, so I'm up and at 'em.
All right. See, it is a glamorous lifestyle that you live.
Yeah, right.
Okay, well, thanks a lot. We appreciate
thanks.
You being on.
We'll talk to you soon.
Okay, bye.
Bye.
That was Sarah Kramer. We're just talking about her new book that you'd like feedback about, ideas that you could send her about what you'd like to see included in a travel book for vegans, and what recipes from the recipe books that she's done over the years that you would like to see included in the book. It's called Vegan a Go-Go. We were just speaking with Sarah Kramer. You can always send any messages to us, too, and we can pass them along. You can write us at animalvoices@gmail.com. We're going to take a little break, come back with Beta, Beirut for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. Hi, welcome back to the show. I'm Lauren, your host for today. Today we are speaking with people from Beirut for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. It's great to have them back on the program. We spoke to Maggie in 2006, August of 2006, while the conflict with Israel was happening. We also had a group from Israel on talking about a situation for animals there. And we wanted to revisit the issue, especially because things are getting quite heated again in Beirut. And we wanted to hear more about what has changed, what new challenges Beirut for the Ethical Treatment of Animals is facing, and perhaps also how you can help. So it's my great pleasure to welcome Maggie back to the program.
Thank you. Thank you for giving us this opportunity to be heard outside.
Well, as you see, the situation is back to be tense. There's no bombing as before, but there's still, like, the Cold War, as you call it, like, car explosions, financial problems, you know, everything is getting more expensive, local fundraising is almost gone, and local adoption, too. So these are the kind of problems that we're facing right now. And it's worse than before, because before people would hear about the war would help more. Now they don't hear there's war, but at the same time there is this same effect, but there's no bombing.
Mm.
Yeah.
When we talked to you last, you were in the process, at the very end of the interview, you were in the process of picking up a cat off the road. You literally got off the phone with us and then went and got a cat that was on the highway. And I wanted to hear more about if there's still as many strays around. Are the situation for Beta anyway, is it the same that you were facing back then?
Yeah, it's definitely the same. I want to talk a bit about this cat. We called him Love. We got him, and he's so cuddly and loves to kiss everybody. So he was called Love, and now he's in the U.S., actually. He got adopted there. And we're still facing a lot of stray animals on the streets. We have a problem of stray cats and dogs, of course. And we're the only animal welfare group in Lebanon, and we're trying to work on staying and neutering these animals, but there's no resources. And since now there's no government, as you know, Lebanon has no president at the moment. So it's very hard to go to the municipalities and ask them to help us stay and neuter.
Can you walk us through the shelters? Because I know there's two shelters now that Beta has been running. Can you give our listeners a sense of what the shelters are like, where they are, who runs them, the animals that are there?
Yeah. At the moment, we have 220 dogs and 120 cats. The dogs are actually located in a pig farm. The pig farm was donated to us by a kind guy who gave it to us right after the war, because, as you remember, during the war, our cat shelter was nearly bombed. We had to our dog shelter, and we had to evacuate, and we moved to this pig farm, and we accommodated it in a way that it could have dogs. It's still not the best, but this is the only thing we can have at the moment. We have 6 workers at the shelter and like 5 volunteers a week go there, and 3 founders who work with the dogs. And at the cat shelter, it's like 2 apartments that we fix them in a way to be cat trees. We have the cat walks inside the shelter. It's always clean. We provide high-quality food and volunteers, medical care, and we're trying hard to work on adoption.
You mentioned that the cat named Love was adopted out to the United States, and I know that there was a number of adoptions. I think there was, it mentions on the Beta website, 300 animals went to a sanctuary in Utah?
Yes, true. I don't know if you heard of them, Best Friends Animal Society.
Mm-hmm.
They took 300 animals last year. Right after the bombing, they sent us a plane, cargo plane, and we flew with the animals. Actually, I went with them. It was quite an interesting experience to be with 300 animals on one plane. And
can you tell us more about that then? What was it like?
Well, first the feeling was very tense. You know, the preparations. It's something that the first time happening. I think it's the first ever flying animals all over from the Middle East to the U.S. Never happened before, and that big number at the same time. And the plane was full of barking and meowing and vomiting and pooping. I'm sorry to say that live on the air, but this is the exact situation. And we were like a team of 7 people who had to clean all the time until we got to New York. It was an 18-hour flight. And we had to clean the 300 cages at this time so we can get to the customs and have everything clean. And then from New York, we flew to Vegas. And at Vegas, there was a team of volunteers from Best Friends all waiting. They took us with the cats and dogs, and we drove to Utah.
Mm.
So it was a long trip, but it was really exciting.
How did that partnership happen between Beta and the Best Friends?
They responded to our plea during the war. it just happened. They said, we're taking your animals, and they sent the crew here, a cat shelter manager, dog shelter manager, manager for the whole operation, a vet assistant. They came and helped us microchipping the animals, preparing the booklets, and they sent us food, too, during the war, because we didn't have food in Lebanon. All the suppliers were closed. There were no resources whatsoever, so they didn't help us greatly. And recently, like after the war, they funded an executive director for us, and he's working now with us to improve Bita's organizational status.
One of the images that really stood out for me from the interview from 2006 was when you talked about dogs that had been living off the condensation off air conditioners. And you said, you know, this is a situation with the bombings that were happening at the time where the infrastructure is down and these usual sources that strays would have to sustain themselves on things like air conditioner water are gone. And I was wondering if we could talk a little bit more about the situation now and where the strays are coming from and where these animals are coming from. How do they end up coming to Bita?
Mostly they're like rescues from the street or abandoned pets, because in Lebanon you would see a lot of stray on the streets, and if you are an animal lover, you wouldn't want to be walking here, because at every corner you're either finding a colony of cats or dogs. Dogs are more common to come at night, but these dogs are mainly abandoned because we don't have awareness here. So people buy puppies, and then they find out that a puppy needs a lot of care. They put them in the street, so we end up picking them up. But at the same time, being a pro-life organization, it's very hard to keep up with this. So it's very hard here. That's why we need to work on spaying and neutering. And also there's like the fact of now the car bombs, as you hear on TV all the time. Our last visit to the vet, we were driving there, and right on the other block, there was a car bomb. So as you see, it's very hard for us to be transporting animals at the same time. You know, you have to restrict moving a lot between traffic, and because you never know when a car bomb would come up.
That was the bomb that was in front of the U.S. Embassy?
Yes. Yes, our vet is on the highway taking you, like there's two parallel highways. It was on the other highway. We could hear it, and we could see the smoke, but at the same time, thank God we're not taking the less traffic highway. It was on the less traffic one.
So for people who are listening, and I know I brought this up last time as well, that are saying, well, this is a situation where a country, Beirut in particular, is in strife. Why should we concentrate on animals? Why is it important to help the animals out? Can you give us a strong picture of what the situation is and why it's urgent and why there's been these continual calls out from Bita to help?
It's urgent because we have a lot of stray animals and because we are the only animal welfare group in Lebanon with one shelter for cats and one shelter for dogs. Without people's help, we won't be able to make it alone, especially that we're isolated here and few animal lovers in this country, so we need to reach out to the people outside. You know, their help might be minimal to them, but it would be great to us. Like, even with a minimum donation per month, it will make a huge difference in here. So there's no way we could fundraise locally. We're trying our best. We're not giving up. We're trying to get more and better every day, but without these people out there, we won't be able to make it. And we recently launched this new program. It's a sponsorship program where people could sponsor, and it would be recurring donations. It's very easy and safe. So this is a very important step for us.
And people can find out about that by going to the website?
To our website, which is www.betalebanon.org. And they can go to donate or sponsor, and this will help us. If we could get 1,000 sponsors, we would be able to pay as many animals as possible. And in a few years' time, we won't have any suffering animals on the street. Our problem is that we don't have free vets, so we have to reach the commercial vets. They give us a low-cost paying neutering, but still they take money because this is their source of living. So that's why we're unable to stay that big number of animals. But we are hoping now in this year, once we have a president, if we ever had, to make a deal with the municipalities and pay neuter the cats and dogs on the street, especially that dogs are being poisoned and shot.
And it's just, like, we get calls at night sometimes, please come pick up this colony of dogs, or we're shooting them right now from the police, and we don't have space.
The numbers that you mentioned, and it seems like this is something that could be very easily sort of depersonalized for people, that, you know, to talk about strays in general. I'm wondering if you can talk about some animals in particular that you've come to know, or some stories that can make the animals stand out a little bit more as individuals, because it's, I think, hard to wrap our minds around what that's like there.
Okay, I'm going to give you one story that really has touched me recently, and I wasn't able to do anything about it just because I'm in Lebanon. There's this dog who is, like, put in a small box, and the box is covered. He can't see sun or light or anything. He stayed in this box day and night till Sunday, so his owner take him for hunting. It's a pointer. And we spoke to the owner, we spoke to the police, there's nothing that can be done. There's no laws in Lebanon, and there is nothing whatsoever that you can protect an animal. That's why we want to become stronger as an organization, so we would be able to create laws and help such cases. And this dog, trust me, I cannot forget him, because I saw his face. I was wondering what's in this box. This is one example I could give you now.
Is there any other stories that stand out that you'd like to share?
I can't think of one particular. There's so many in my head.
I know that you have people, I've read about people just leaving the animals on your doorstep.
Yes, one of these animals is a cat called Tia. She was left in a garbage bin, and it was sealed with scotch tape, and it was put on our door. We didn't know it's the cat until the evening she started meowing. Everybody thought it's somebody else who put the garbage outside, and then suddenly we hear meowing, and it was a cat. This is one example of dumping animals. Same with puppies on the door shelter, at the shelter, dog shelter. They put them in a box and just leave them there.
There's pictures online, too, of baboons. Is it just cats and dogs right now? Are there other animals at the shelters?
No, it's just cats and dogs at the shelter, but we do rescue other animals like the baboons you just mentioned. We try to confiscate them from pet shops if we were able to, because we have a lot of baboons and monkeys in here, all kind of monkeys and even chimpanzees. So the one we rescued, we were able to send them to Wales, to a sanctuary, and now they're in, like, a sanctuary for primates.
For people who want to know more specifically where their money will go, I know on the website there's a breakdown of some of the finances, but I think that the idea of running a shelter, maybe people don't necessarily know right away why it costs so much money. Maybe you could tell us more about that.
Yeah. What costs so much money is the food, first of all. We have a food bill every month that we have to pay, otherwise the animals will not eat. And we are obliged to give a good quality food so we can keep the animals healthy, because, as you know, they're together and you have to keep their immune system in a good shape. So this is a high cost. And then we have the workers to keep the animals healthy. We need to clean all the time. And we also need to medical expenses, staying and neutering. To stay a female dog in Lebanon is $120. And that's for us. That's a special price that the vet give us as a charity. So imagine if we have to stay all these dogs. Same with the cats. It's not cheap. It's $70 per cat. So such expenses. The money goes for medical, paying neutering, cat food and dog food, and the workers. And that's it, basically. And we have a lot of, like, sudden expenses, like, just last week, one of the founders just picked up a dog off the highway who was hit by a car, and both of her legs need to be operated on. This operation cost $600, and that's a sudden expense.
Right, so those are the daily expenses, and then, of course, these other things that are coming up with veterinary care.
Yeah, so every week, and we're not, like, just sitting here and waiting for money to come. Every Sunday, we're doing flea markets. We're still doing our best, even if people... if we have minimal amounts coming to us, but we still go and try to fundraise as much as we can. And
how do you make sense of what's going on in Beirut in terms of the way that the situation is for animals? Why is the situation so bad, do you think?
because Lebanon has been into wars since I was born, I guess. So it's very hard for people to understand animal welfare where there's no people welfare. So this is what we're trying to do now in Beta. I'm sure there's a lot of people who love animals, but they just need to be aware about it. So that's why we're targeting schools, and we're doing our best to make some presentations, to introduce it to children, to show them that animals are sentient beings, and they can feel pain and hunger. And we're amazed by the reaction that the way they discover the stuff. So I think it's because of the war people are like this here.
So when they do find out about the work that you're doing at Beta, how have people responded?
Positively, most of them, and some of them, the ones who are like hard to understand it, we try by example. Like, we bring the children to the shelter, and we show them how the animals eat and how they feel pain, how they take medicine and all that. So it is good in that sense, but at the same time, there's a lot of people we're not able to reach, just because we are a few number of people. We're not like a lot. We're now 6 active founders and volunteers, like there's around 20 volunteers, but still not enough for the whole country.
Why do you think that you have gotten so heavily involved? What made you different in this situation?
I don't know, I always ask myself this question too, but I guess since I was 7 or 8, I used to love animals and just wanted to be around animals. And then when we met each other, bit by bit, we all like teamed up and created Beta. And Beta, I think, is the place for every animal lover in Lebanon, because whoever meets us is so happy to have met us. You know, it's like being alone for a while, and then you find someone who shared the same and the common feelings and compassion. So that's why we think that Lebanon have a potential, but we just need the help of the outside world. Because once we have like more funding, for example, we could go more advertising Beta, more getting people to know about Beta. It's all like, it's a circle.
It sounds like things are improving for Beta slowly.
Yeah, we will never give up, no matter how many wars there are or whatever there is, because I think the animals in Lebanon have us only. So if we give up, then there's no one else to come up.
Do you ever get burnt out? Do you ever feel like giving up? Like, what
I
gets you
going?
I
feel frustrated, but
yeah.
I do feel frustrated, and I don't know if I was on the verge of giving up sometimes, but then again, one story come up, this animal got adopted, like, especially the animals in the U.S., when we get stories from people there saying how our animals are being treated, or how this dog won the prize of being the best dog in the school, and while we know that this dog came from the garbage or from being tortured, and by the way, every dog we have has pellets in him. This is like a habit people do here. They just practice on dogs. So when we hear stories of these dogs who were tortured and poisoned in this country, and then they go to another country being so well treated, it's just like made us tear up and then feel, okay, there is hope. Let's try more and not give up.
We only have about 4 more minutes left, but I wanted to turn it over to you if you have a final message, or if you wanted to plug the website again or give people any information that they need to contact Beta.
Yeah, I would like to stress on the website, which is www.betalebanon.org, and I would like people to read our stories, sign up to hear more about us, and become sponsors. You know, no matter what their donation is, it will make a difference. We have a target to reach, and this program will help us budget our monthly finances and know that this month we have dog food, we have cat food. This is what we need. And once we have this basic expenses covered, we can expand and do more advertising, more new staying and neutering, help more animals. So, yeah, I would say to people, please pair a drink. I don't know how much drinks cost in Canada, but in Lebanon, each drink costs $10. So with $10 or $20 a month, they can help an animal actually have a shelter, a home, and a future family.
Can you give us the website just one more time?
It's www.betalebanon.org.
Maggie, thank you so much.
Thank you.
One of my regrets from the interview from 2006 is it was very difficult to hear about everything that was going on, and before you, or I guess it was right after you got off the phone, I realized that I didn't wish you well and to tell you to take care of yourself too. So I wanted to pass that along now and to say that I tried to convey that after we got off the air last time, but I didn't get a chance to say it directly
thank
to you.
Thank you. And really, thank you for remembering us and for giving us this opportunity to get our voice heard. And thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you. Bye now.
Okay. Bye-bye.
We were just speaking with Maggie from Beirut for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. If you'd like to hear the program that we did with her in 2006, please do go to our website, animalvoices.ca. If you have any questions or comments about this program, ideas for upcoming shows, do write us at animalvoices@gmail.com. You can also check out, our whole archive pretty much. There's 200 plus shows that are on the animalvoices.ca website. We encourage you to download them, enjoy them. They are all free. Next week we're going to be speaking with author Barbara Gowdy. I'm thrilled to have her joining us. We're going to be talking with her about her book about elephants called The White Bone. It's going to be fun to speak with her. We also have Akira Lippitt, who's going to be coming up on the program. An interview with Isa Chandra Moskowitz is in the works. Also a vegan punk horror writer, I believe. We're going to be talking with him sometime soon.
Count David.
It's going to be good. Again, you've been listening to Animal Voices on CIUT 89.5 FM. Thanks for tuning in. Please stay tuned. Is Sergio in the house?
Sergio's not in the house, but Dos Mundos is coming up.
Okay, great.